Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Hi there, and welcome to the Explaining History podcast. And today we're going to talk about the arrival of Woodrow Wilson in December 1918 in Europe for the Paris Peace Conference. Wilson, who had joined the war, not the First World War, not as an ally but as an associated power, the USA never became a full ally of Britain and France, but an associated power, in April 1917, had a very specific set of outcomes that were hoped for from the Paris Peace Conference. If you read The Deluge by Adam Tooze, I know it's a book that I've cited many times, Adam Tooze puts a wrecking ball, really, through the idea that Wilson was a liberal figure who, in the interests of peaceful world governance and liberalism worldwide, went to Paris and tried to create a kind of rather benevolent new world order to prevent wars from breaking out. Adam Tooze says this isn't the case at all. He was acting almost entirely in American interests, and saw all sorts of opportunities to reshape the political and legal structures of world trade and governance to suit the United States of America. What Adam Tooze argues is this. He says that by 1916, America had eclipsed all her European rivals economically, and France and Britain and Germany, all, you know, fighting one another, with France and Britain on one side and Germany on the other. Even though they were fighting one another, they all looked nervously at the growth of American power. The Germans rightly predicted that there was a high possibility that America might join with her enemies. But the British also looked at America and wondered nervously if America would eclipse the British Empire. Wilson was certainly no lover of German militarism, but he had no sympathies at all, really, for the British or French empires either. To Wilson, they represented closed doors to trade. Wilson made much of talking about self-determination for all peoples, but he himself was not particularly concerned about colonised peoples in Asia and Africa. His own record on race relations in America was pretty deplorable. Instead, he saw empires as unfair cartels, ways of capturing markets and forcing out legitimate competition. The First World War had accelerated trends which had existed within the British economy prior to the conflict, of declining productivity and an increased struggle against international competitors, particularly Germany and the USA. And the crisis that Britain finds itself in at the end of the war is profound. It's come from being a creditor to a debtor nation. And if you want the lowdown on this, I did a podcast a week or two ago on Britain's forgotten depression from 1920 to 1922, and that will give you the story of Britain's declining economic fortunes. Wilson knew he could capitalise on this, and he knew also that the means by which the British safeguarded their economic interests around the world was through the Royal Navy, which guarded the routes to empire. And Wilson simply said, we'll build a much bigger navy if we have to. We've got shipyards that can churn out battleship after battleship, and we're not worried at all by the threat that the British pose. The British Royal Navy, which had reigned supreme for the best part of about four centuries, was facing obsolescence at the end of the war. New armaments, aircraft carriers, U-boats, and other means of waging war at sea had placed the Royal Navy on notice, really. The Royal Navy doesn't decline in power in absolute terms until after the Second World War, but it certainly was going to be, in a very short period of time, unable to contend with the new US Navy, the newly developing US Navy. And the Washington Naval Conferences are a big clue to us, which show that British realised accommodation would have to be found on the high seas. Again, I've done a podcast on the Washington Naval Conferences. You can search for that through the list, and that should give you a lot of insight there. The journey that Wilson has across the Atlantic on the George Washington, it leaves New York in December 1918 to great fanfare. Wilson is seen as the man who is going to, from the New World, who is going to finally resolve the problems of the old. And this is a kind of a pivotal moment in America's international and diplomatic history, because it is a moment whereby there is a kind of a widespread consensus that America is taking on an international leadership role, the sort of role really that America appears to be retreating from right at this very moment. The ship is full of experts from government, from university departments, full of diplomats. There are huge staterooms on the ship, full of boxes of information, reports, studies, reference works on the diplomats that Wilson will be meeting. This is the first visit of a serving American president to Europe while in office. And the opponents of the president in Congress alleged that this was unconstitutional. Can a president actually leave the USA and leave the business of the USA unattended to and swan off somewhere? Nobody knew, because it hadn't been done before. It seems unlikely that a Supreme Court would be able to rule otherwise. The interesting thing about Wilson's journey across the Atlantic is that he seems to be one of the more forward-looking leaders who was at least trying to build some kind of game plan about how to deal with Italy, France, Britain, Germany, and a host of other countries. When he actually gets to Europe and actually begins to engage in the negotiations at the Paris Peace Conference, a lot of the preparation is swept away by the realities of, you know, the facts on the ground, the long struggle to make any kind of sense of the peace. Wilson didn't expect to be in Europe for nearly 6 months, but that's certainly what happened. His good friend and advisor, Colonel Edward House, who becomes a key and trusted ally for Wilson at the conference, thought that Wilson would come along and initially iron out the frame of debate, the terms of debate, of discussion, and then go back to America. But this is not possible. And it's not possible because you need to understand really the scope of the Paris Peace Conference. The Paris Peace Conference, as Margaret Macmillan puts it, her book Peacemakers is a kind of the standard text on the subject, standard kind of revisionist text on the subject anyway these days. The Paris Peace Conference is really the centre of world governance for 6 months. From the end of 1918 to mid-1919. It's not just the restitution of Europe that's decided there, the shape of the Middle East, the rights of Japan in China, the future of German colonies in Africa and the Pacific, the development of the League of Nations and institutions that come from the League of Nations, such as the International Labour Organization. All these were key issues. The future of Russia, whilst not brought to the Paris Peace Conference, was argued by many, including people like John Maynard Keynes, that it should have been, that Lenin should have been invited to the Paris Peace Conference. The Wilson sends emissaries into Russia. Jan Smuts, the South African general and later premier, goes to the new Soviet Union to try to work out really what it is the Russians want. So it's a vast and expansive settlement for really much of the world. There is virtually nowhere that isn't in some way affected by the Paris Peace Conference. There are delegates from every continent. So it was perhaps a naive expectation on the part of Wilson that he could turn up, essentially dictate the topics for discussion, and then go home. Wilson had a huge burden of responsibility in terms of representing America at a major peace conference for the first time. And everybody from Roosevelt all the way through to Bill Clinton have really drawn from the legacy that Wilson left. American peacemaking and conflict resolution, however, valid those concepts might be, in this discussion.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Have been influenced by the Paris Peace Conference, the Oslo Accords, the Camp David Agreements, Paris Conference, the Geneva Conferences, over the Vietnam War. All these things have been shaped by Wilson's actions in 1919. The irony, of course, is that Wilson had never really intended to be a foreign policy president. But there are few American presidents that really do have this intention. Most of them speak to a domestic audience that is far more interested in living standards and in law and order and domestic issues than the affairs of other countries. Perhaps one exception to the rule would be Nixon in 1968, who campaigned in large part on a policy of withdrawing from the Vietnam War without losing face, the honourable peace proposal. Now, having suggested that Wilson had cynical and mercantile interests at heart at the Paris Peace Conference, which, by the way, were no more cynical than any other major power there, the British and the French certainly had nothing but self-interest, really, when it came to the conference. Wilson was also influenced by ideas of democracy. He saw Britain and France as kind of imperfect versions of democracy, but certainly far superior to German and Austro-Hungarian militarism. The British and the French were, in his eyes, imperial democracies, and they might hopefully bring voting rights to their subject peoples one day. But as far as Wilson was concerned, there was nothing redeemable about Germany or Austria-Hungary, which, again, it is to misrepresent, really, particularly Germany. Germany was a less democratic society than Great Britain was. It had an elected Reichstag, but an appointed chancellor. However, Germany was certainly a far more democratically progressive country than Britain and France's chief ally, Russia. There is a brief glimmer of hope as far as the Allied powers are concerned in 1917, when the February Revolution happens and the Tsar, who was generally disliked by the British and French and seemed to be the architect of his own miseries, is deposed, and then 2 months later, Wilson enters the war. And it's only at that point that people like David Lloyd George start to really bandy around this idea of it being kind of a war for democracy. Britain disenfranchised 40% of its adult male working class population. So a great many of the British soldiers in the trenches wouldn't have had the vote until 1918 in the Representation of the People Act. But the factors that bring Wilson into the war are obviously Germany's reckless, unrestricted submarine warfare programme, which resumes itself in 1917 and begins the sinking of ships from America, travelling to Great Britain, and the killing of American citizens. And it also presents the principle that Germany can decide where American ships can and cannot go, and how Americans can and cannot trade. And once again, access to world markets is the key to American wealth, and America will not tolerate that key, that wealth being threatened or imperiled. And also the even more reckless Zimmerman telegram, intercepted by British intelligence and presented to the world, is the final straw for American public opinion. Reckless, unnecessary, and a sign, really, that the Kaiser and his government saw American involvement at some point as inevitable. Much as Hitler in 1941 saw it as inevitable, and following Pearl Harbor, Hitler declares war on the USA before the USA can make the decision to declare war on Germany. Wilson had campaigned in 1916 for his second term on a platform of neutrality. He was a Democrat politician of the Progressive era. His background had been partly in practicing law, but mainly as the president of Princeton University. So he had a kind of a scholarly air about him. There was something deeply attuned to legalism and the rule of law. And so he could exude a kind of righteousness, a certain kind of what one might call a stuffiness that his political rivals and other foreign dignitaries either mocked or ridiculed a little bit. Certainly, I think David Lloyd George said that he, on one side he had Clemenceau, who was Napoleon. On the other side, there was Wilson, who was Jesus Christ. He was one of the Progressive era's social reformers. He believed that whilst the power of capital had been transformative in America, it needed to be reined in. The unrestrained workings of big business and markets had devastating social consequences and a devastating impact, and this needed to be curbed now. And one of the political traits he brings with him to Europe is a dogmatism. Some might describe it as self-righteousness, but an absolute conviction that his cause is moral and righteous and must prevail. And when you look at his pursuit of the League of Nations and the compromises and sacrifices that he makes, particularly with regard to the Japanese and their involvement in China, to establish the League of Nations, that assessment isn't too far from the mark. A French ambassador, this is in Margaret Macmillan's Peacemakers, a French ambassador in Washington saw a man who, had he lived a couple of centuries ago, would have been the greatest tyrant in the world, because he does not seem to have the slightest conception that he can ever be wrong. During the war, and before America's involvement in the war, Wilson had offered to mediate as a honest broker. This mediation was rejected. Wilson, when he joined America in the war as an associate power, had always retained the threat of a separate peace agreement with Germany. That meant that unless certain conditions, particularly conditions about the peace talks, were met and agreed to by the French and by the British, particularly this idea of what Wilson called peace without victory. And what that really meant was a peace that was an armistice followed by a peace treaty where there was no punishment, or if there was punishment to be meted out, it was to be meted out by on all sides equally. The idea of there being a peace with victory was that it was going to be a kind of a punitive Carthaginian kind of peace where Germany was to be forced to pay the price of the war. Wilson didn't want to be seen as the figure who was really picking sides in that way. Not because he didn't prefer the British and the French, marginally he did, but because his objectives at the conference were to bring to an end European imperialism, which would serve his altruistic goal of democratisation, but also his wider goal of throwing open world markets to American industry and commerce. Wilson was happy to accept that the German people were capable of a redemption, that they themselves could be saved, but Germany's leaders needed to be punished. The German Revolution in the winter of 1918 to 1919, the overthrow of the Kaiser, gave a great deal of encouragement to Wilson. He thought that this was evidence that the German people had listened to his 14 points and that perhaps democratisation might spread across the rest of Europe. On the voyage across the Atlantic, Wilson tended to lock himself away in his cabin with his wife away from the rest of his delegation. And diplomats were unsure as to what America's policy when they got to Europe actually would be. So much so that, for example, William Bullitt, who would later go and become one of the kind of the giants of American diplomacy in the 20th century, had to go to Wilson and say, we don't know what it is you intend. Can you enlighten us? This obviously didn't go down very well. As we'll see when we start to look in more depth at the Paris Peace Conference, as we're going to work through this one in the coming weeks, Wilson's ideas met with the cold, harsh reality of realpolitik, which often David Lloyd George and Clemenceau were far better at and far more able. Okay, so I've gone on for perhaps a bit too long there on the subject of Wilson, but if you want to hear more and you'd like to fund us and give us a bit of help and help the podcast to grow, you can check out our Patreon page. The link is with the info on this podcast. Or you can go to the iTunes page for Explaining History. Give us a vote, give us a thumbs up, and we'll catch you on the next Explaining History podcast. All the best, bye-bye.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.